This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Small Moments, offering a wide variety of professional and social graphic design services, from logos and marketing materials to invitations and print to frame. Learn more at smallmoments.biz. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. My name is Renee Powers, and I am the founder of Feminist Book Club. I absolutely love today's interview, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Leah Johnson is our guest, and you probably recognize her name from the brand new best-selling book, You Should See Me in a Crown. Leah is so easy to talk to, and time absolutely flew by. She is a fellow Indiana girl like me, and this book is set in Indiana, and both Leah and her book feel like home to me. Our discussion covers a lot of ground, as it usually does. If you've read her book, you will love hearing her talk about crafting these characters. And if you haven't read it yet, make sure you stick around because we discuss a lot. I particularly love our discussion of Black joy and Black fiction in this moment of civil uprising and revolution. But first, a few things about Feminist Book Club subscriptions. I am so excited to announce that our July book of the month is With the Fire on High by Elizabeth Acevedo. Our theme this month is food, and so 5% of all of our revenue that we raise will go to Soulfire Farm, which is a BIPOC-centered community farm committed to ending racism and injustice in the food system. Our July boxes are sold out, but if you want to get the book itself and only the book, you can sign up at the book only level. And 5% of your sale will also go to Soulfire Farm. Anyone signed up for the book subscription in July will be the first to know when August boxes are available, and we will only have 50 boxes available. And I anticipate they are going to sell out again. So if you want a chance of getting one of those August boxes, make sure that you are signed up at the book-only level. It's $20 a month. You'll get access to all of our online discussions as well. And those never sell out, so join us anytime. But for box subscribers, if you already signed up and you know that you've got one of those July boxes, here's what else will be in them. In addition to With the Fire on High by Elizabeth Acevedo, you will also be receiving delicious-smelling wax melts from Take a Little Whiff, planner stickers from thisisus.org, vegan mug cake mixes from Coconut Whisk, and 3 adorable note cards from today's sponsor, Small Moments. So let me tell you about them a little bit. Small Moments is a one-woman graphic design firm in Detroit, Michigan. Designer Kimberly is so wonderful and I'm telling you, she is so easy to work with. She has a deep passion for creating designs that reflect her clients' personalities, whether it's quirky, something fun, something sophisticated. If it's an invitation for a housewarming party or a logo or for a social enterprise, I promise Kimberly gives every product her undivided creative attention and energy. So be sure to contact her for any and all of your design needs or check out some of her pre-made designs at smallmoments.biz. Now on to today's interview. Hi, everyone. I am so excited to be talking with Leah Johnson today. Leah is a writer, editor, and eternal Midwesterner. Currently moonlighting as a New Yorker, she is a graduate of the Fiction Writing MFA program at Sarah Lawrence College and currently teaches in their undergraduate writing program. Leah is a 2021 Lambda Literary Emerging Writers Fellow, whose work has been published in BuzzFeed, Autostraddle, Catapult, and Electric Literature, among many others. Her best-selling debut YA novel, You Should See Me in a Crown, was an Indies Introduce and Junior Library Guild selection. Her sophomore novel, Rise to the Sun, is forthcoming from Scholastic in 2021. Can't wait for that. But Leah, hi, welcome.
Hi, it's so cool to have best-selling in my bio now. It wasn't like that 2 days ago.
I saw that on Twitter and I was like, I am not surprised.
Thank you. I was shocked, I gotta say.
But we have to start with our first question. What does it mean to you to be feminist?
To me, feminism is the textbook definition is about the equality of the sexes, right? But feminism is nothing without thinking about intersectionality. So when I'm thinking about feminism, I'm talking about our trans sisters, I'm thinking about disabled sisters, I'm thinking about Black, brown, queer, across every spectrum of identity. We're advocating for all of us to come up together. And so that's feminism for me.
I think you just defined intersectionality in the most succinct way that we have heard on the show yet.
Oh, good, good. You know, like, I think because it's part of my pedagogy, because I teach not only creative writing, but I also teach a class about rhetoric that is based in nonfiction writing. And so one of the tenets of our class every semester is to spend time talking about intersecting forms of oppression. And so, like, when we talk about any writing, we talk about any type of art, we also have to talk about the political context that art comes out of, right? And so I'm constantly thinking about the gazes that are being put onto any given work. And so when I'm teaching the kids about it, the reason why I'm so quick with it is because I need the young people, I need my freshmen to get it quickly so that we can get down into the nitty-gritty of the text.
Absolutely. I mean, and what better way to approach intersectionality too. I TA'd a rhetoric and pop culture class where
it's one of those classes.
Yeah. Yeah. We took a lot of just like really common pop culture texts. Anyways, I digress. I have to ask, we have to talk about your book, You Should See Me in a Crown. So can you give our audience, if they haven't picked it up yet, which they will, I assure you, can you give us a quick description of it?
Yeah, so You Should See Me in a Crown is about a girl named Liz Lighty whose only goal is to get out of her small and small-minded Midwestern hometown and go to college. She wants to become a doctor, but those plans are derailed when her financial aid falls through, and so Liz has to run for prom queen for the scholarship that's attached to winning. That's tough enough for a wallflower like Liz, but it becomes even more difficult when she starts to fall for her competition.
So good. So this is an own voices Black queer girl with anxiety in the Midwest, and I live for it. I want to talk about a lot of the themes that come up with it, but let's start with Liz herself. Why did you decide to write from her perspective, and why did she decide to write this story?
Yeah. So a couple of years ago in 2018, actually, so it wasn't that long ago, but what is time anymore? You know what I mean? In 2018, I wrote this essay for Electric Literature called YA Taught Me How to Love Like a White Girl. And it was about growing up reading all these like rom-coms where white, often affluent white girls, East Coast, West Coast. So it was always like a coastal kid, like getting these like swoony love stories. And obviously everything that I am, all the boxes that I checked were absent from those narratives, right? But they were what framed my idea of coming of age and what framed my idea of what it looked like to be in love and who is worthy of love. And so I wrote that essay, and that's how my agent found me. And she was like, you got something maybe that you're cooking up over there that answers some of these questions? And you know, fast forward a bit, I started working on You Should See Me in a Crown. We sold the book before it had been written, so we sold it on a proposal. And I knew immediately that the job that I wanted to do in You Should See Me in a Crown was to write into all those empty spaces that I identified when I was growing up. And so Liz is the antithesis of your quintessential rom-com heroine. She is deeply anxious. She is growing up in relative poverty. She's not raised in two of her direct parental units in a two-parent household. In that way, she's raised by her grandparents. She's child of a mother who died of an inherited blood disease. Like, you know, Liz is very different from all the things that I thought marked people who are worthy of having beautiful love stories. And so by crafting her in all of those absences, she came together to be this like girl who was very similar to me growing up, very much feels like an outsider in her community, just wants to do right by the people that she loves, but doesn't feel as though she's doing that successfully all the time. And yeah, so that's where Liz came from.
It was this book as fun to write as it was to read?
You know what? I had a lot of fun writing. I will say I wrote this book while I was writing this book. I was also working three jobs. And so I think it was an escapist fantasy for me while I was doing this. Like, I'm going to work from 10 to 6 and I'm taking an hour to eat dinner and call my mom. And then I'm writing from 7 to 11 and then I'm going to work on my job that I work at night or whatever. And so like the break in my day that I got to spend in Campbell County were the brightest parts of my day. Was I exhausted while I was writing them? Yes. Was I often frustrated while I was writing them? Yes. But they were very much like an escapist outlet for me.
The theme of joy and specifically Black joy is so salient in this book. And I know that was something that you wanted to highlight when you're writing it. Can you talk a little bit about that theme and why that was important to you?
Yeah, so I think it's worth noting that as we're recording, there are protests raging on across the country in the fight for Black lives. And so now more than ever, I'm thinking really critically about what Black liberation means and what Black liberation looks like. And I think at the heart of any story about Black joy or any story about Black liberation is a story about Black joy, is about being able to move freely without fear of violence or prejudice. And so Liz's story is not separate from those things. I'm dealing with racism, the type of racism that you encounter in the Midwest. You know, these protests rose out of Minneapolis, the type of racism that happens in small towns, the type of alienation that comes with being different in a small community. And so it was important to me to be honest about those things. But for any reader who comes from a community like that, who checks the boxes that I check, who is queer or Black or a woman or, you know, all the above, any of the above, it was important for me to give them that and give it to them honestly, but also show that, like, despite those things, it is possible for us to have the happy endings we deserve. And one day, hopefully, I'll be writing books like this that don't feel fantastical. You know, it feels like something that is very believable for people like me. And so, so that's what I'm thinking about a lot when I'm thinking about Black joy right now. Also, like, let kids be kids. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like we haven't historically had a lot of queer YA that centered Black girls and that gave them the happy endings they deserve. One of the stats that I think is most interesting is somebody ran the numbers in 2018, right? It's 2 years ago. Somebody ran the numbers in 2018. In the 3 years prior to 2018, there had been one YA novel that was published with a queer Black girl as the protagonist. That's outlandish. That was 2 years ago. That's not a lot of time. And so, you know, we're looking at a genre that is devoid largely of stories like this. And so there is a certain level of radical joy that is also happening on the page here. It's like we're usurping white supremacy in these really small ways, but also, like, because we've never seen this before, we're at the beginning of what it can be, at the beginning of what this industry and what this genre can look like. And so, yeah, I'm trying to write into that. I'm trying to really claim that with both hands.
Yeah, I'm going to use your words that you shared with me, that you are working hard to diversify the queer canon. And I think that this will absolutely go down as not just one of the first, but one of the most, like, enjoyable YA, just like fun and immersive. And I was reading through the Goodreads review before we hopped on here, and I was just like, yeah, this is exactly, everybody's saying that it was fluffy and fun, but not like too saccharine and not too tropey. It was just like, it's exactly what we need right now.
Thank you.
But we've also been needing it for so long. And so we're finally seeing it get the recognition it has so long deserved. It is getting a lot of press. It is a bestseller. Are you, and I want you to be honest here, are you surprised by the amount of buzz that you've gotten so far?
You know what, Renee, I'm gonna give you two different answers to this, right? And that's one, like I said, we haven't had a lot of Black queer girl rom-coms to point to before. And so a lot of times, you know, you come into the industry and you can point to something else where it's like, okay, that's been successful. And so we can do that again without reinventing the wheel. And we know it'll work this time. Not to say that I'm the first to ever do it. I don't think that I'm like the vanguard of whatever, but I will say that there weren't a lot of different examples that I could point to that had been marketed really heavily, that had received a lot of support from their publishers, that had been as widely well-reviewed as Crown has become. And so I was cautiously optimistic about its success because I didn't know if anybody was truly prepared for what I was trying to serve in this book and my subsequent books. That said, I had very few goals going into this, right? Because I tried to keep my expectations low. I'm a nihilist by nature. And so I just, you know, I try to prepare myself for the worst, right? And so I'm not a list girl. I'm not a starred review girl. Like, those are not things that I'm aspiring to. But what I wanted when I started this, I said, I want a starred review from Publishers Weekly and I want to hit the indie bestseller list. And those are the things that I wanted. And those are two of the things that I've gotten. And so I did hope that those things would happen. And I guess the undercurrent of hope is that you believe that it's possible. And so, yes, in that way, I was expecting it. Also, I am very fortunate that I have a team that believes so deeply in this book. Even when I was like, you know, like, they're going out for blurbs, right? And they're like, you know, you put together a wish list of your favorite writers. And it's like, they were sending the book out to people. And I was like, they're never going to read the book. So I don't even know why we're sending it to them. And those people have since like tweeted about the book and posted about the book and like followed me on social media. You know, like, it's, that's been unbelievable to me. But I was, even when I didn't believe, my editor believed, my mom believed, even when I told, when I was like, Mom, we hit the list, we hit the bestseller, she was like, it's kind of anticlimactic for me, Leah, I'm not going to lie, because I knew that this was going to happen. So, you know, I had my doubts, but they never did.
It's so good to have those people to fall back on, though. Like, how wonderful to have a team and a mom that just believes in you so truly and purely. I'm so glad that you have that.
Yeah, I'm really grateful and I'm really fortunate that I lucked into being the person on the receiving end of this affection and support.
The question I had actually came back to me and I wrote it down. So, and it's again about kind of this revolutionary moment that we are in, this time of people finally acknowledging that maybe Black lives do matter. I say that with all the sarcasm in the world. And we've seen a lot of, especially in book media, we've seen a lot of book lists being published. And okay, so if you're new to this fight, if you're just now recognizing your own white supremacy, like, here are 15 books you should read. And they're, you know, Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo and Leila Saad. They're all nonfiction. And what I have been really passionate about is getting fiction, Black fiction, into the hands of readers, because that is what makes a difference. Yes, you can read about anti-racism until you're blue in the face, but if we're really going to start acknowledging Black stories and really humanizing for white folks, especially who haven't really had that experience of reading Black fiction, this book is perfect. It couldn't have come at a better time.
Thank you. Yeah, I was like, obviously, I've spent the last couple months being like, well, couldn't be a worse time to come out with a book. I'll tell you that. We got a pandemic on our hands. I can't tour. I can't do events. I can't really, you know, get out there and hang out with booksellers, which is so crucial, getting FaceTime with indie booksellers, because they're the ones who are out here on the ground hand selling your book every week. They're not an algorithm. They are the thing that you have to get on your side in order to get your book to move, really. So I was like, well, you know, the book's going to do what the book is going to do, and we're going to figure it out. I have another one coming out next year. Maybe that one will be better. So I was ready to, I was going to go hard for this book regardless, but I was ready for the potential that it would not perform super well. And so in the past couple of weeks, obviously, these protests have risen up in different cities across the country, in every state in the United States, actually. And along with it was a wave, like an overwhelming wave of support for Black literature. You know, even looking at the New York Times, like, nonfiction list last week, not YA. Don't look at the YA list and expect to see it be diverse, because that was not the case. But the nonfiction list, absolutely. It was like 13 or something, 12 or 13 titles out of 15 were by Black people. It was incredible. But I think part of why that is because people want an actual blueprint for how to dismantle racism in their own life. They want somebody to tell them, here are the steps, here's the background to structural inequality, this is why it is the way it is, and so that they can be like, okay, so if I donate more money to this thing, then I can do this, and if I just like tell my grandma to shut up, then I could do this and that. You know, everybody wants really clear-cut solutions. But the thing about Black fiction, especially in a moment like this, is that the way that you dismantle racism in your everyday life is to treat the Black people that you know with respect. Like you, it's, and it's often, these are things we don't identify in ourselves, because that's the thing about privilege, right? Is that you never have to engage with issues unless you want to, because they're not being shoved in your face every day like they are for everybody else. And so, like, there are microaggressions that white folks perpetuate in their everyday lives that you may not understand until you read a book where a Black kid is just trying to run for prom queen, and she realizes the chances of her being able to win in her town are very slim because nobody like her has ever won before, and nobody expects her to win. Nobody is really rallying behind her. So the villain, and You Should See Me in a Crown, well, the villain is racism probably, or homophobia, but, like, you know, those things are manifested in the form of a character named Rachel Collins, who is like, I try not to read Goodreads, but people have been like,
racist Regina George, is that what you're referring to?
Thank you. Yes. So people I have like called I'm her so like good. The cardboard cutout of a mean girl. And one of the reasons why I made her the character that I made her, like, it didn't give a backstory about why she sucks and why she's mean and da da da, because, like, that's not how racism works. Like, there isn't like a origin story that makes a racist a racist. Right. You're racists are created. Like, every day that you are told that you are superior and the Black and brown people in your life are inferior, that builds onto that character of racism. Like, every time you can go into a space and nobody has to do a double take, or you can walk into a store and nobody follows you, like, that's how racists are built. And, you know, sometimes they're radicalized on the internet, they find their corners of Reddit or whatever and become like virulent racist. But most racist people are everyday racist. Like, you are the people who cross the sidewalk when you see a Black person walking across from you. Anyway, I said all that to say, nonfiction can give you the blueprint for how to do, like, the large scale, like, this is racism and this is what we have to do to unlearn it. But I think fiction gives you a humanizing aspect of things and tells you, like, hey, this is an experience that you've never had, that you've never had to engage with before. Engage with it, and then maybe you'll understand more deeply why everyday acts of racism are just as insidious as the kinds you hear about on the news.
And I think it's so important to have it contemporary fiction as well, because I think there are a lot of, I was looking at the bestsellers list recently too, and I think mm-hmm. a bunch of Toni Morrison got on back onto the bestsellers. And that's great, but I think that yeah. people might read that and be like, oh, well, this was the past. But it's like, yeah, The Bluest Eye was
yeah, that's the problem.
The past, but it's still happening.
Black folks who are descendants of American chattel slavery have been here for hundreds of years. And the things that we are advocating for now are not all that different than the things we were advocating for when Alice Walker pinned The Color Purple, or Maya Angelou wrote I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, or like James Baldwin is doing all of these brilliant novels about Blackness, global anti-Blackness. And, like, you look at a text like, I don't know, Dear Martin or The Hate U Give, and at the core of it, the story that we're telling is not all that different than the story that was being told in To Kill a Mockingbird. You know what I mean? Not by a Black writer, clearly, but about, like, a brutal injustice faced by a Black person. And so I said all that to say, I'm with you. I completely agree. I think there's no better time to engage with contemporary fiction, particularly contemporary YA.
Yeah, agreed. I have to ask, you just mentioned James Baldwin. You open the book with a James Baldwin quote. I wrote it down. The place in which I'll fit will not exist until I make it. How did you come across that quote? And how did you choose and decide, like, that's how it's going to open?
I came into a much more nuanced understanding of race and the American identity when I got to college, because I double majored in journalism and African American studies. And my African American studies degree had a concentration in Black literature. And so in my first, like, 20th century Black lit class, I was reading a lot of Baldwin. And I realized that so much of what he was talking about, like I said, were things that I was interacting with every day in my life. And this comes from not even a book. This comes from, like, a letter, I think, that he wrote. And it just felt so appropriate to the conversation that I was interested in having. And You Should See Me in a Crown. It's like, Liz doesn't want to win a Nobel for race relations or for, you know, like queer liberation. Liz just wants to be Black and out and not have to fear being on the receiving end of some sort of violence, right? And so her entire journey is this journey to understanding, if I want to move through this world, I am going to have to carve out spaces for myself to fit because nobody else is going to hand them to me. And so, yeah, that's how I settled on that quote. And everybody who hasn't read Baldwin, I suggest going out and reading him. It's one of the greatest to ever do it, truly.
Yeah. Yeah. We get Giovanni's Room recommended on the show often. So I have not picked up any James Baldwin yet that I think of. Maybe back in college, but I'll have to, I definitely have Giovanni's Room on my like to be read as soon as possible.
Yeah. It's good. It'll really reframe it. I mean, just on a sentence level, the way that Baldwin is so careful about the way he crafts story, like, and I'm not talking just like overarching, like a lot of times we talk about craft, we're talking about like plot, we're talking about character, but I'm talking about like just word for word, bar for bar, Baldwin is eating the girls up every single
That's Love the kind him. Of writing I like. Yeah. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about these characters too, because we've been talking about a lot of just like cultural things that are going on and how this fits in, how this book especially fits in the culture. But the characters are so, so lovable. And I'm wondering, I just like, how did you write them? I particularly love how nuanced they are and how kind of flawed but beautiful and like sweet. And these are like complicated relationships that we all had in high school. And so I would love for you to talk a little bit about maybe your favorite characters and how you came to them.
Yeah, so obviously Liz is my favorite character. I love her deeply. So I feel like I can't even talk about her in any type of impartial way. But aside from Liz, my two favorite characters are Robbie, who's the little brother, and Jordan, who is the childhood best friend who they have a falling out, but then they have to come back together their senior year during prom court. And yeah, I loved working on those characters because those relationships were rife with so much history. Obviously, like Liz has such a deep love and sense of duty to her brother, and you can tell, or at least I hope you can tell, that Robbie feels that same way towards Liz. Like they are just in this continuous feedback loop of like, okay, well, I'm gonna help you in this way, I'm gonna help you in this way, I'm gonna help you in this way. And it's so close to my heart because I have a younger sister who's the same distance and age from me as Liz is from Robbie. And so when I was working on that relationship, I was thinking a lot about my sister and about just like, she's the funniest person ever. I think she's hilarious and she's so smart. And it's like a secret hilarity and a secret brilliance. Like she's good at like bringing it in under the radar. And I wanted that type of like subtle hilarity and subtle like tenderness to exist between Robbie and Liz. But Jordan is like one of my favorite characters to write because in the John Hughesian school of thought, he kind of, I don't know if he ever said this publicly, but I feel like this is at least how he must have done it. It's like he has these cardboard cutouts of these characters, and they are caricatures to begin with. It's like you have the jock, and you have the hot girl, and you have the outcast, and you have the brain, and literally it's just the plot of
the Breakfast Club. Yeah.
And so as the story goes along, you unfurl those ideas a little further, and you know, the jock is not just the jock anymore. The jock is the kid with the complicated relationship with his dad. And the brain is not just the brain anymore. The brain is the kid who is so used to being smart that when he's not the best at this thing, that he doesn't know what to do with it. And you know, and so I wanted to give every supporting character that same type of story. It's like, you think that like they're one thing when you begin the book. And then as it goes along, it's like, okay, it's a little more nuanced. And Jordan is a prime example of that. Jordan is the hot jock, and he's also a jerk at the beginning of the book. Like, what we know about Jordan is that he's done this terrible thing to Liz, and that it's like irredeemable. It's like, okay, so we have this jerk and that's who he is. But you know, as the book goes along, Jordan becomes this real symbol of not hope for Liz, but you know, comfort, safety for Liz. Like, he is there in all these really important ways for her, and he shows up for her in moments when nobody else shows up for her. And we also get a little background about his family, and we find out about this girlfriend that he really cares about that, you know, has disappeared mysteriously at the beginning of the book. We don't know where she went. And yeah, so he's also one of my favorite characters. I also think he's just so funny. So yeah.
He is so sweet. I loved reading Jordan. I just thought, I feel like I knew him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I knew Jordans in high school.
That... Yeah, he's very much just a regular high school dude. Like,
yeah.
Who's like trying to live up to this expectation of like hyper masculinity, and he plays football and he's going to the Ohio State. And so he's like, you know, he's here. And so Jordan is like, in a lot of ways, Jordan is expected to abide by these really rigid rules of what it means to be a guy's guy. But then he's just so tender and he's so sweet and he likes playing video games with his friends. And like, he's just a good kid. Yeah. He reminds me of a lot of the guys I knew growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. We are winding down this. I could talk to you. I still have a list of a bunch of questions, and we'll just have to save it for next time because you are working on your sophomore book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in short, Rise to the Sun is a book about two girls named Tony and Olivia who go to a music festival searching for two very different things. And along the way, they find each other and realize that they need each other's help to accomplish their goals over the course of this weekend. In truly a Johnson book fashion, they might just fall in love a little. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But the line that I'm using to explain this, I'm really short, is like 3 days, two girls, one life-changing music festival.
She says this as she's wearing a Bonnaroo shirt. Don't act like I didn't see that.
I was hoping it was like washed out. No, you could see it. I feel like such a hippie.
It's okay. I have a brewery shirt on. We're good.
Okay. Yeah, you get it. It's like, you know, this weekend, it should have been Bonnaroo weekend. Like, I should be in Manchester, Tennessee, getting sunburnt and eating super unhealthy fried food right now. And I'm not. And so I'm like living vicariously through this book. I'm like looking at my pictures from last year, just like crying into my computer. It's just, you know, I miss festival season.
Well, this book, I've had Billie Eilish in my head for the entire week since I finished it. Is this named for the Billie Eilish song?
It is. It is. It was, the title was taken from the title of her song. Yes. Which comes from a show with Hot Priest.
Hot Priest from Fleabag?
Yeah. He's on another show. He plays a character called Moriarty on, Sherlock, I think it's Sherlock, it's something like it, which I don't watch, but that's where she got it from. And then I got this from her, and so maybe somebody will write a musical called You Should See Me in Your Crown. They'll be like, yeah, I got it from the book. And then so it'll keep going.
I love this kind of like his history derivative phrase. Yes. And but the fact that it starts with Hot Priest, can't get better than
you
that.
Really can't go wrong with that. That's such a strong place to begin.
amen. All right, so my last two questions are easy ones. So if we want to connect with you online, see what you're up to, what's the best way to do that?
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, my website, YouTube, all at the handle by Leah Johnson, BY Leah Johnson.
What do you do on YouTube?
Yeah, I don't know.
I wasn't sure if you were like a booktuber.
No, I'm working on this blog series called Debut Diaries, and it's a series of videos that details like the major milestones of my journey to publication. And I'm going to be releasing those periodically for the rest of the summer. It took me a minute to get it to start editing them because I didn't know how trying and taxing releasing a book was going to be. But yeah, so if you want to find out more about my debut journey, go subscribe to my YouTube.
I love that. We will leave links to all of that in the show notes, as well as You Should See Me in a Crown. And my final question, do you have a book that you would recommend to our audience that they should check out? Not your own.
Yeah, I have so many. I'm like, oh my God, where to begin? I'm like looking around at my bookshelves. Yeah, so my recommendation is going to be All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson. It's nonfiction, and it just got optioned by Gabrielle Union, so it's coming to your screens everywhere. It's a just brilliant rumination on race and sexuality and how we're going to move forward from this present moment. And it's perfect for right now, especially if you're interested in engaging with more Black writers and you need something to add to your shelf for pride. So this is it.
It's perfect read. Perfect read for right now. Thank you so, so much for joining me, Leah. This has been an absolute delight, and I am not surprised. You Should See Me in a Crown is so joyful and so fun to read. And I hope everybody out there goes out and get it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.